planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zayas.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
We know deception, crimes, and cover-ups are instrumental to the way the power elite does things, from staging coups, overthrowing leaders, creating false flags, and carrying out assassinations. They stop at nothing and spare no expense when it comes to advancing their hidden agenda, securing their wealth and power, and deceiving the masses from these realities. However, out of everything they've done, nothing has helped people see the light better than the very public assassination of JFK and the sideshow circus that resulted in the aftermath. Dare I call it the Gateway Conspiracy for most of the American people, and those wise enough have been looking at events with a skeptical eye ever since. And be that as it may, few people realize the real depth of this saga, what Lee Harvey Oswald was really doing, and how this related to a cancer-causing monkey virus that has been administered to millions of Americans under the guise of a vaccine, making the death of a president in Dallas really just the tip of the iceberg. Well, lucky for us, after decades of having to bite her tongue, Judith Vary Baker has come forward to share her story of being intimately involved with Lee Harvey Oswald, as well as a secret operation to weaponize cancer, which she details in her two books, Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, Participant in Anti-Castro Bioweapon Plot, Friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and Key to the JFK Assassination. I commend her bravery in breaking the silence, and I'm very happy to have her here. Judith Vary Baker, welcome to the Higher Side.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, this is a serious treat for me. It's very surreal to talk to someone who has such intimate knowledge of these people and events and was very much involved firsthand. And for people who might be unfamiliar, I know you've talked about this story quite a bit in recent years, but tell us about how you got involved with this cancer weaponization project, which, of course, brought you to Lee Harvey Oswald as well.
Okay, and also I'm hoping that when people read, the book is David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, briefly wanted to say that a lot of people thought that David Ferry hated Kennedy. I just wanted to, in case we don't get back to it, he actually did express hatred for Kennedy, and the fact that he said Kennedy ought to be shot at a particular meeting of retired military officers in New Orleans right after the Bay of Pigs. Well, they made him get off the stage, but as a matter of fact, he actually changed his mind later, but these men surrounded him and said, you know what, we feel the same way. And you're a talented pilot. You're going on from here to all these Texas cities. You can courier information for us faster than the U.S. mail. You know, he's trained pilots for, you know, anti-Castro. We trust you. And then see, David Ferry changed his mind. He found out who was really responsible for the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs. And he realized that it wasn't Kennedy. And now he was in a position where he didn't dare say, hey, I changed my mind. I like Kennedy. Because they're talking about how to kill him.
Right.
This is one of the ways that Lee Oswald was able to get information. And that's why it helped him to penetrate. So you'll find over 500 pages in the book, David Ferry, Mafia Pilot. It's the only book ever been written about David Ferry, of course. For people out there who don't know who he might be, Joe Pesci played that character in the film JFK, and he is the first murderer that you see in that film. So I just wanted to say that Lee Oswald knew him. I met Lee by accident. It seemed that way. Actually, we know now that it had to have been set up because they knew I was going to the post office and all that. I was invited to participate in a cancer research project with Dr. Mary Sherman. Dr. Mary Sherman is famous today for different reasons than she was back then. She was a famed oncologist and cancer researcher. Her papers were always being quoted. She was someone that I just admired so much, and she was working with Dr. Alton Oxner in New Orleans. And Oxner had been overseeing what I was doing for quite a while. We have all the newspaper articles and everything showing how the group of Dr. Alton Oxner, Dr. George Moore, and Dr. Harold Diehl, they went around testifying about the dangers of cancer if people smoked. and they went to together to trials and all that. And they met me and mentored me because I'd given mice cancer in only 7 days. You can read about all the details of that in the book, Me and Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here I was, you know, invited to New Orleans, and I was so excited, but I was invited 2 weeks early, and my doctors were out of town. Briefly, when I got there, they weren't there, and I had nowhere to go. I didn't want to go back to my parents. If you read the book, you'll see why. But here, there are special reasons why I was invited. I was invited because, for example, I had worked in Dr. George Moore's own private laboratory at Roswell Park Institute, and I also went to seminars there that were run by Dr. Morand.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing I was working with, Dr. Moore, what's important about this is that there's a formula called the RPMI 1640, and it's still used today. This formula was being created at the time I was there, and would come out a few years later, perfected. But I had the formula to grow cancer faster than anybody. In the newspapers, you'll see that I was given the order, actually, to start researching on how to make cancer more deadly. The excuse they gave me was that, after all, if we can find out what makes it grow, that'll give us an idea of how to kill it. You see, that's the approach they use. Actually, they were in a process. It started on March 23rd, 1962, to weaponize cancer because the CIA had tried all kinds of ways to kill Fidel Castro, and they had not succeeded. They didn't want the United States to be blamed. Here he smokes cigars like a maniac, you know, one after the other. And being sent to New Orleans and out of Florida and out of sight, out of mind, you might say, I was practically untraceable. In fact, while I was in New Orleans, I was Judy Vary, but I married Robert Baker while I was there. When I was kicked out of that program for protesting for the use of prisoners, they were going to be injected as volunteers with this material that had been developed. If it worked, it would kill them. And I'd been told originally they had terminal illnesses. Turned out they were perfectly healthy.
Mm.
They resembled Castro in size, height, and genetic characteristics. At least one of them did. I saw one prisoner, Lee saw another. So we know there had to be at least two. So that's background on that. Now, I arrive in New Orleans and expecting to be working with Dr. Sherman, so excited. And they're on South America. I came 2 weeks early because the University of Florida got out on a schedule different. It was trimester schedule.
Mm.
So there I am, and I only had $42. That's equivalent to about $400 today. That's not an awful lot if you don't know where you're going and they don't want you. Nobody's paying your way. I mean,
no.
Yeah, it was scary. So at the YWCA, they said, well, I'm sorry, you're not on the record yet. I said, but, you know, I was invited. Here's my ticket. You know, the doctor had paid for my ticket to get to New Orleans. Well, you'll have to wait till they get back. Sorry, lady, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing there for me. And, oh, my gosh. Well, I decided I'd pay the least I could and moved in to a room that already had four girls in it. And there were two strippers and a Playboy bunny and a tough waitress, okay? And they're all young girls, but they were already getting kind of brassy and tough because of what they were doing. And I had to pay one of them 25 cents a day so she wouldn't steal my stuff. That she was guarding it, you know? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, so nobody would steal it.
Little stripper mob going on.
Right. All right. So they were taking me around. I saw strip joints, and I went to the show bar and in the back rooms and watched the girls put pasties on. These are things that were really different from what the experience I'd had with the human body, which was testing for cancer and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was shocking. And here I'm waiting for my fiance to come. I didn't want to tell him what I was doing because I was afraid if he knew I was offered a job, not only this job for the summer, which was I got a stipend for it and all expenses paid and so on. But in the fall, I would be able to enter Tulane Medical School 2 years ahead of time. I was enamored of Robert Baker. He had an IQ of 186, and I think I was more fascinated with that than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he was a fairly good-looking guy, too, and could play a good game of chess. And I mistook sex for love. People do that.
Mm-hmm.
It was so different with Lee Oswald than that. That was real love. Anyway, there I am in New Orleans, and Robert said he'd come and marry me, and he didn't ask me. He said, I'm coming, but first I have to clear it with my folks. Well, he hadn't planned to go to New Orleans, so it took him a while to get there. But I told him I was going to stay there all summer, and I didn't want to tell him everything because I was afraid he wouldn't marry me. He still had another semester to go at University of Florida, and he had switched to geology. So I said, look, come to New Orleans. Come on, follow me here. You can get a job here. There are a lot of oil companies, you know, and so on. Check out the schools. It'd be wonderful for you to you know, get your master's here in geology. So I convinced him to come. Well, of course, he was delayed because his parents had no idea, and he didn't want to tell them about me because I came from a Catholic family. I had Hungarian blood in me, and they were very white, and I was, well, his mother said I was swarthy. I had swarthy skin, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, and even though I have blue eyes, you know. Anyway, she said, look, doesn't even have to wear nylons. Her skin is so swarthy.
Yikes. Yeah,
well, she could have said tanned, you know.
How rude.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That woman would say so many things to me when the others weren't around. Well, anyway, you can read about it in the book. And so he didn't want his parents to know anything about it. So I even wrote, I was only allowed to write one letter to him. And I also put an ad in the paper because he was afraid to call. All this fear, you know. Well, so I was going to the post office all the time to see, because he promised to write every day. Well, dang gummit, he didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was angry. And like 3 or 4 days had gone by, and he said he'd write every single day. And no letter. So obviously, people could see that I was visiting there every day. I had gotten a part-time job at Royal Castle, which is a long bus ride way out on Airline Drive in Kenner, but the waitress was leaving that job, and they took me on part-time in the morning until they could find somebody for full-time, you know. And I, of course, wouldn't want to stay. I mean, it's hard to get income. Anyway, it was enough to help pay my bill at the YWCA. This is important because it looked very strange to Lee Oswald. Now, Lee did come to the post office, and I thought it was all an accident. Actually, they must have known. Lee said that later he would tell me that he actually arrived the day before. Now, I'm standing in line here, and I write this one letter, and I put an envelope, and I mark it on there that is from, it says R. Rourke, you know. Well, mm-hmm. Robert told me to put his friend's the male name on there, Rourke. And it was sent to R.A. Baker, okay? Robert A. Baker at Eglin Air Force Base, where his parents were actually erecting some housing for, you know, for the military out there. So they were getting their mail out there.
Okay.
Well, for Lee Oswald, looking at this, he told me later, he saw an envelope that looked like it said R, A. Rourke. The cursive R I wrote looked a lot like an A.
Okay.
And the Rourke, he knew Alexander Rourke and Jeffrey Sullivan, the CIA associated pilots. And he had recently, later he would tell me, he recently met Rourke, Alex Rourke. Alex would be the pilot who would try to get me to pick me up in the day that Lee Oswald actually crossed over into Mexico, okay, at Laredo there. I was supposed to get on a plane that was going to be flown. I was going to be flown in by Rourke and Sullivan. That plane was shot down that day. And they've gone missing. They've been missing ever since. It was a frightening thing because we suspected that this was no accident that Cubans shot them down, but maybe, you know, an attempt to make sure that Lee and I would never be able to get away. They were setting up there in Mexico City all kinds of ways to frame Lee Oswald, and I would have been an impediment to that because we would have met and we were going to try to get out of there. We were going to go to the Cayman Islands. And everything. Lee left he left his suit. You can see Lee in pictures, Lee in his suit that he had from the Soviet Union, a dark suit that he wore for interviews on right after August 9th, around August 15th, 17th, somewhere in there, because he looked very nice. That suit is missing from all the collections of his personal items. Lee actually left a suit and a lot of his nice clothes in a locker in Laredo. And we have, of course, a record that the FBI searched the lockers, the bus lockers and so on in Laredo. We also have a record that they searched the safety deposit boxes in the two banks in Laredo. So I went recently to Laredo and showed them other records. So Lee had someone there and actually picked him up. Lee did not ride a bus back across over the border. Nobody ever saw him do it. They try to assume that. They always try to say he's a lone nut. But Lee was associated with others who were with the CIA and so on. All right, I'm giving you that background information because Lee's looking at this R. Rourke and thinks it's an A. Rourke, and it's to Robert A. Baker at Eglin Air Force Base, and that's where it turned out that you have an FBI agent that Lee knew. His name was Robert A. Baker. So you've got Rourke and Baker on the same envelope. I'm handing it over. Looks like I'm a courier of some kind, right? That's what Lee thought. Then when he finds out later, we're walking along, that I worked at Royal Castle. That Royal Castle out there on Airline was just a few blocks from Town and Country. And Bobby Kennedy's team was out there doing surveillance 24 hours a day, using that Royal Castle every day and all night, watching the comings and goings, because that's where Carlos Marcello, the kingpin of the mafia that Bobby Kennedy hated, and of course Marcello hated Kennedy, that's where he was located. And here I'm going out there for only a couple hours every morning, early in the morning, and I go back, I mean, all the way into New Orleans. Nobody in their right mind would just work a couple hours in Lee's head. You know, he's saying, why would she be out there just a couple of hours and then leave? Maybe she's currying. He thought, she's got a curry your job, you know, just like this Alex Rourke thing. That's obviously, that wasn't me, and I'd put that on the envelope. On top of that, I had put this ad in the paper, and I had carried it under my arm around with me for several days, and I said, circled it, and I kissed it with lipstick, and it was in code. Robert said, put something in the paper so I know you got there. If I use the phone, they'll know I made a long-distance call to New Orleans, you know, and he didn't want that. And so I put to Jario and pretty here and, you know, and right and all that. Well, when I put that envelope on the counter, I dropped the rolled-up newspaper, and Lee, standing behind me, he picks it up. Now, I'm irritated because Robert Baker hadn't written, and I'm not married to him yet. I'm still a free woman. And I look at this nice-looking guy behind me. He hands me the newspaper, and I thought, I'm going to use this break the ice with him. And so I said in Russian, because I thought he'd say, what did you say? I said, Karasha tovarish, you know, like that. In other words, well done, comrade, when he handed the paper back to me. And Lee answered me in Russian. It just blew me away. He said, it's not wise to speak Russian in New Orleans. I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather. It was my grand way of saying hello to a guy. Why did I even flirt with him? Well, I did it because first I was angry. Second, he didn't have a wedding ring on his hand, or so I thought. Soon I would notice that he did have a wedding ring. It was on his right hand. Because Lee was married in Russia, and just like my grandma did, she was Hungarian, he wore his wedding ring on his right hand instead of the left. So I was fooled, see? I would have done that. So people need to know that, you know?
Yeah, it's an important point for your character.
That's
but
right.
I don't think you mentioned this yet, but Lee was also a runner for this ring of secret labs you were involved with, right?
Yes, that's what it turned out. Originally, he was not going to be doing that. Originally, he was going to be a photographer in New Orleans. And then he learned that Herbert Philbrick, who was his, when he was a child, that was his hero. Philbrick had written the book, you know, I Led Three Lives. And Lee had seen him on TV 6 or 7 episodes in New York. Now, his brother thought it was in Texas. And so then they discredited that. Because Lee's brother Robert said, oh, Lee saw those in Texas. It was his favorite show. But it wasn't playing in Texas at that time. But it was playing in New York when Lee was there with his mother when Lee was around 12 years old. So he did see some episodes, and he told me they brought tears to his eyes. He wanted to do the same thing. He wanted to be a spy. He wanted to do like Philbrick did, pretending to be a communist. And at the same time, he'd be handing over information to the FBI. And his desire was to enter the USSR while he was still a teenager. So this was stuck with him. He tried to join the Marines when he was 16. He had a faked birth certificate. This is how much he wanted to, you know, serve our country. He did join at 17, You'll see in Wikipedia and other places, they say he dropped out of school. They don't mention that he got his GED when he was in the Marines. He dropped out of school in order to join the Marines. And they don't put that in that context. They say they make him look like a real failure. He dropped out, you know, and then they have paragraphs. And then they say he joined the Marines. Well, actually, he dropped out right away in order to join the Marines. His heart was set on serving his country. He was reading Marx. He was reading Engels. He was reading Lenin and all this communist literature that the Warren Commission says he was reading when he was so young, starting when he was, couldn't have been more than 13 when he began reading all of this. And he's smart, very smart. But what they don't mention is he was reading Thomas Jefferson. He was reading the Federalist Papers. He was reading Leviathan. He was reading the great works written by our American patriots, our fathers, our founding fathers. They don't mention that he was reading both sides and knew very much about both sides.
Obviously, there's been a lot of character assassination.
Of course they do. And of course, they've done it even to everyone they possibly can. Mm-hmm. Even to President Kennedy, their focus on his foibles and his sins without, so the people don't realize the greatness of this president. And fortunately we have the Devil's Chessboard, that book out there by David Talbot. And we also have JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas. These two books really show the courage and the greatness of this president. Mm-hmm. This president had to be murdered, had to be got out of the way, so that a man whose overriding ambition was to become president more than anything in the world, Lyndon Johnson, could come in, try to take his place, even to the point that Lyndon Johnson got himself a rocking chair so he'd look like JFK.
Mm-hmm. Man, so I also really wanted to talk to you about the cancer side of things here. You mentioned Alton Ochsner, of course. People might remember him as the doctor who publicly injected his grandkids with a polio vaccine to prove it was safe, and then one died pretty soon after, and the other one contracted polio.
Yeah, a week later, his grandson died, and the other one had polio.
Right.
That taught him a lesson, and he even talked to me about this. You see, he said, look, Judy, you know, we have all kinds of people out there who trust their doctors. Even I trusted my doctors, and I put my children at risk, my grandchildren. And he said, don't you think that Castro trusts his doctors? See, turned out there were a lot of doctors that pretended to just be his friend. But it's not the doctors that had the problem so much as that we could really work with the techs. What a lot of people don't understand is that whereas maybe Castro's doctors were just as loyal as they could possibly be, when the doctor asked for a vial of penicillin, he asked it from a nurse or a tech. They get it out of the refrigerator. Or let's put it this way, even if the doctor goes to the refrigerator and something's labeled, they'll take it out. It was so easy. You see, you can't see cancer cells. You could put them in a liquid that looks just like like a dose of penicillin. You'd never know. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that Castro was getting x-rays about once a year. He would get his different shots because he was out a lot in the jungle, had been in the jungles and so on. And they always checked his health. It was important. And he had a DPT shot coming up, I was told, and so on. Well, imagine now if you let's just go to the President of the United States, put him in front of an x-ray to see how he's doing. And all of a sudden, you know, he looks fine, just looks just fine. But what do you know back then? If a tech is in charge of that big x-ray console and they turn it up and they then ask that. So think of it that way. Bring down the immune system with a big dose of x-rays. And that was part of it. The other part is messing up one of his blood tests. That is, Castro was going to have some blood withdrawn to see how he's doing. Do you have anemia, you know, so on. And you take a smear and you put it under a microscope. And you know what? If you see cancer cells running around in that blood, imagine. You're going to put him under the x-ray again and look if you find any tumors, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be easy to contaminate a slide with cancer cells. A tech could do it again. And if you're going to send him in front of x-rays again and there's another tech has really zapped up, then he's going to get sick. He's going to feel badly. Then they're going to give him like maybe penicillin. They're going to try and make him feel better. So we had this kind of arrangement worked out. Why do we have this kind of cooperation? It wasn't necessarily because they hated Castro because of what he was doing, because a lot of people, Cuba, liked what Castro was doing. But as a matter of fact, Castro had changed the whole medical system around. They weren't making a lot of money anymore. Mm. All right. They were on salaries and they were being sent out to help the peasants. And the other thing that was going on is instead of being sent to Ochsner and others, you know, like to Mayo Clinic or whatever for training, but Ochsner got a lot of them. These young Cubans were being sent to the USSR and they felt they were getting inferior training. And of course, they could never become famous doctors like Dr. Ochsner. So you had a whole bunch of young doctors or those working as techs who wanted to become doctors who were very dissatisfied with the fact that they weren't going to become rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a massive story, but obviously there were several different methods discussed to get Castro. And obviously in the end, we know that didn't happen, but
I feel like we were so naive. Now remember, Lee was only 23. I was 19 when I met him, and we believed our leaders. We believed Ochsner. We believed these eminent doctors. But when when Lee was supposed to take that bioweapon all the way to Mexico City and hand it off, if you think about it, would we really risk handing over a biological weapon to a Cuban? All right. Bottom line, we were fooled, but it brought Lee Oswald into Mexico City and they were able to frame him there. And we have fake telephone calls to Kostikov, a USSR assassin. We have all kinds of shenanigans going on to make Lee Oswald look like he really wanted to go to Cuba more than anything in the world. Well, in the end, he did try to get in.
Mm-hmm.
He hoped that he could get this material in himself, but there was a shelf life on it. You know, after a few days, you have to change the fluid. Lee knew how to do that and make one change to get new fluid into this cancer soup, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that you then faced is how you can't live in a thermos, glass, you know, glass lined thermos like a big test tube. Can't live in there forever. Now, so Lee, after a few days, he has a 2 weeks visa, and here he's trying arduously to get into Cuba, but all of a sudden he gives up. And he's only been a few days, and he returns. Well, he was ordered to return. But all of a sudden, Lee Oswald never talks about Cuba again. He never tries to go to Cuba again. His birthday comes, and there's some indication that he actually got the transit visa at that time. He ignores it. He doesn't even think about going to Cuba again. Why? The project had been canceled. The project was over. So they told him he could go back around Christmas time. He could return to Mexico City. Lee wanted us to go to university. By then, we knew we were under lots of suspicion. We planned to kind of just hide. We had all kinds of things. You can read about all our plans and what we intended to do. Now, what's interesting, I think, to the people here is that they need to know that Lee Oswald was a very brave man. And because of David Ferry, who had gotten this information that I talked about in the beginning, Lee was able to penetrate some of the groups that were in Dallas. They had told him, as I said, that he could return around Christmas. So he did not get a permanent job. The job that he got that was arranged for him at the Texas School Book Depository was just a temporary job. They were always laying off people. In fact, they made room for him. When you have the school year has already begun and most of the books have been shipped out, you do not need another book carton handler to locate books when you already have two of them. They already had two clerks that were picking out books out of boxes and bringing them down to be shipped off.
Right.
And they were already laying off other people. Lee was actually in this Texas School Book Depository. He was placed there on purpose. And he told me, you know, this is even better than Riley, where he had to clock out and I would cover for him. And he would clock in, I should say. I'd usually clock him out because he wasn't even there. So we covered for him and I put my J, or Monahan would put his M on the time cards, and that cleared them. That he made so many hours when he wasn't even around. And Lee tells me, you know, on the phone, he says, you know, it's even easier here at the, he called it the building. He didn't call it Texas School Book Depository. He called it another name. The name of the whole building had a different name than that. And he told me at that time, you know, all I have to do here is she fills out that I've been working here all 8 hours and I come and go as I please. Sure enough, we have a record. I'm trying to find it, the original in National Archives. I'm going to find it. unless it's being held back. Right now, they're holding back a lot. The FBI is holding back a lot of records right now that they're going through which ones they're going to release. What's silly about this is that a lot of these records have already been released. So they're going to be a huge batch of records that have already been released. They're going to re-release them. Some of them were pulled out of circulation. Well, you'll find that there was a record of Lee's last day of work. That was November 22nd when Kennedy was shot. And as you know, Lee Oswald was arrested within 2 hours of Kennedy's being shot. But the work record shows that he worked a full day at the Texas School Book Depository.
Mm.
Yeah, uh-huh. All 8 hours. Hey, how yeah. about that?
You're adding a lot of clarity to this. And it's just such a huge story with a lot of details. I wanted to ask you a few questions about the wider implications of this story and how it might affect even listeners and their families. Because you said that, you know, you guys trusted Alden Ochsner, which
oh,
is
yeah,
not something he's a bit of a eugenicist.
We know the cancer weaponization occurred. And unfortunately, that's it was 50 years ago.
Right.
So imagine what they've done now and how sophisticated.
Well, they said that they had gotten this simian virus out of the polio vaccine, but yet you've said you've seen cases up until 1999 that they still had it in there, right?
Yes. Here's the thing. Probably most of us are carrying it. The trouble is most of us don't go for us who die of cancer. They're not going and asking for an additional test to see if they have the simian virus, you know, the monkey virus SV40 in their system. So when they do, they were finding a 60% of them were carrying it.
Mm.
And this is so many years afterwards. In other words, it's carried now from daughter, you know, to children. Husbands would get it from their wives. Maybe it could be any fluids would transmit it. But mainly you're looking at it coming from the mother to the children. It's passed along, just like it is in monkeys, for heaven's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say, oh, no, this don't connect this to AIDS either. Now, I did not develop AIDS, and I'm not pleased that the History Channel has accused me of saying that I worked in the laboratory that developed AIDS. I worked with people who later apparently did work with more viruses, and there's a good lot of evidence that despite what the government says, that we definitely were working with the precursors of the AIDS virus and all the associated problems you have with that. The polio vaccine is very, very simple virus it's loaded with. And they were grown on the kidneys, macerated kidneys of monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And these were filled with all kinds of viruses, never cleaned up. Now, when they said that 98 million people got this in 1963, what they failed to tell you is that those were what were on the shelf. They kept producing this.
Right.
They said, well, after all, you know, we'll get a cure for cancer before this is going to show up. Because in humans, since it was a monkey virus, it wasn't as active. It takes time. And, of course, they've done everything they can to try to prove that the monkey virus doesn't cause cancer. But how come it shows up in so many people who have cancer?
Right.
Well, that's the bottom line. If you could look at it under a microscope, you'd see that the polio virus is very interesting because it's like a donkey. It can actually piggyback other viruses on top of it and carry them anywhere it wants to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like that.
Well, see, that's what makes me curious, because you were told that you were working on a cancer weapon to kill Castro, but these other implications make me wonder if you think there were other goals and objectives of the secret ring of labs other than...
Well, that's it. I mean, and of course, they were all separated from each other. I saw sign-off initials. The reason David Ferries was off the grid like that... Now, it's interesting that Ochsner, they had been working on this since March of 62, March 23rd, 1962 is... when they decided to put all this together. But it was only days earlier before Lee and I both reached New Orleans. Now, you know, Lee and I reached New Orleans. We were both sent to New Orleans the same week. We actually registered for our cover jobs at the same employment agency, and there were five or six of them in New Orleans, at A1 together. We were interviewed the same day at 640 Magazine Street. And we were hired, that was May 9th. On May 10th, we were hired. because Riley had their work week start on Friday, not on Thursday. I mean, on Thursday, usually it goes Monday through Friday is a work week. Mm-hmm. For Riley, it was from Friday all the way to Thursday. So a lot of people thought that Lee Oswald didn't even start work till May 17th. No, he started on May 10th. He got his first check on May 17th. It's a full week's check. And of course I did too. We were there, though not at Riley's, but for one whole week, we were at Standard Coffee Company where our records were laundered. So we have two records in the Warren Commission report and the 26 volumes where Mr. Monahan says, yes, we did it. Ordered a background check on Lee Oswald. It was ordered by Standard Coffee, and it was ordered by Standard, which was a subsidiary of Riley. So what happened is, of course, we got the templates all right, the stationery, and I explained how we did that in the book, Me and Lee. And then we filled them out. We had so much fun filling out that Lee was a wonderful, model citizen, never been to the USSR, had just got out of the Marines, and never had been fired from a job and so on, and had like the equivalent of $25,000 in his bank account. We made him into what Lee called a rich capitalist pig, had a lot of fun doing it. Well, we did that, and I learned to type better because I was a dreadful typist. I was slow. I was pretty accurate, but, I was so slow. So anyway, after 1 week together on the same day, on May 17th, we both move over to Riley's. And, of course, since he moved, his name Oswald there, mine is Baker. I actually got a check that was issued by Standard, so I can prove that I worked at Standard that week. But by the time we processed over there, they had not yet hit the O's, So Lee's first check was issued by Riley's because we transferred over around 9:30 in the morning. Well, they already cut my check. I was a B, but they hadn't got to Lee's by then. So he has, my check is from Standard. His is from Riley. Why is this important? Nobody realized that Lee Oswald worked at Standard because he had no check that said it. And of course, when I said that he did work at Standard, nobody believed me until I showed the records to them. Hmm. So I have many internal ways of proving that Lee and I were associated with each other, and I saved all these records myself, of course.
Right. And I understand you've been vetted pretty heavily from Jim Mars and Ed Haslam, of course. And I did hear you say in a previous interview, to get back to the cancer thing a little bit, that we could have cured cancer by the 1970s by using bacteriophage. Can you educate us on that a little bit?
Yeah, bacteriophage. That's Greek, phage is to eat, bacteria is. In other words, this is a virus that eats bacteria. They're really cute under the electron microscope. They look like little mosquitoes. They have sippers, the dippers or whatever. They look just like what a mosquito might have. And they sit on legs, like four legs. And down goes this dipper down into the cell. And it'll inject its own RNA in there. And that's the beginning of the end for that cell. Of course, you have to have a lot of them, but they multiply like crazy. What's interesting about bacteriophages is they're easily manipulated and modified to the extent that you really can't patent a bacteriophage because someone else could make a slight improvement and they would patent it too, and it's very easy to do and cheap. Bacteriophage, in fact, is the cheapest way probably there is to cure cancer besides the forbidden drugs, which I'm not going to talk about right now, but please think about Oregon. All right. All right. Seriously, if I had cancer, I would move to Oregon or I'd go to Australia where they allow it. All right. So, or I'd go to the Netherlands, but we're talking about bacteriophage being too cheap to modify. Therefore, Big Pharma is not going to do it because they can't make enough money. Now we have online. You can see a study where they're using bacteriophage, which can be, they've already modified it, so it will go to a cancer cell. Now, you'd think they'd have it attack the cancer cell, because that's what they should do.
Right.
And by doing so, the cancer cell bursts and all kinds of baby bacteriophage would emerge or spray out and continue. Well, the lovely thing is that when they can't find any more cancer cells, they go latent. That is, they don't keep multiplying on nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would want to ask yourself, why in the world aren't we using this? Well, they've found a way to make money on the cheap bacteriophage by they've taught these, I call it teaching, but you understand what I'm saying.
Indoctrinating.
That's right. They can be selected to want to eat a certain particular type of cell. And of course you can, and that they you can modify them genetically very quickly. So there you have this bacteriophage, and it's modified. They have it modified so it'll go to cancer cells. And what have they done? They've piggybacked it with chemotherapy units on the nanoscale. That is expensive, and that is what they're doing.
Mm.
But we don't need that, but you know, it's just another sad litany. We have these cancer, I call them cancer treatment palaces. They're cancer palaces. You look at the money they've poured into these huge buildings, and you ask yourself, when you could have a small clinic, we have dozens of different ways that cancer could be cured, depending on the cancer. Now, some of them are incurable, but there are other ways to get around that. It's just pitiful that we are still in a medieval stage where we're cutting them, burning them, and poisoning them.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
people. It was very sad. A lot of people write to me. One person recently wrote, his mother has died of it, his father has died of it, his brother has died of it, his sister has it, and he's got it. And they can't see that this is genetically linked. You do not want to, the government and others, they don't want you to know that some of these cancers are actually contagious.
Right. And well, I've learned a lot about cancer in the industry from listening to your previous interviews and your writing. And obviously, we've established they want us to stay sick and on the chemo payroll. But an aspect of this that really opened my eyes that you've talked about is biopsies. Can you talk to us about how they make the problem worse?
Yeah, I prefer thermograms, not mammograms, but or x-rays. But you can use a thermogram and you can see hot spots. Now, cancer develops hot spots because they're multiplying so quickly and they need a lot of blood supply. They kind of carry in as much blood as they can. They create an acid environment. By the way, people think that they need to go on an anti-acid diet. And the cancer is going to make acid. That's what they do. Okay. They make their own acid, no matter what kind of diet you're on. What you want to have is a good rounded diet with fresh fruits and vegetables and get your various, we could talk about the various supplements that can help you.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look again at what you were talking about. And would you repeat the question so I do not want to?
What about biopsies makes cancer worse?
Because there are different aspects that we could talk about. For example, even lots of x-rays like mammograms, though, can do so much harm to the tissues. And I'm just I urge people, please choose the mammogram, not the mammogram, but the thermogram. A friend of mine who did this, they found a cancer in her neck because the thermogram will scan parts of your body that besides your breasts, and it saved her life. Mm-hmm. Never would have been detected on her neck, you know, with
right.
the mammogram. All right. Similarly, the idea is you punch a hole. When you have to go and get a biopsy made, you have to take a needle and you insert it. When you do this, you're making an opening to the outside of the body, of course. You know, you're punching an opening in. And even though it's microscopic, it looks like to us, it's when you look at it under a microscope, it's a big hole that's been punched in. And, of course, viruses and everything can enter. So there's always the risk of infection. But here's what happens. It touches the cancer, and it penetrates into the cancer. It's pulled out again, all right? It sucks out some of this. Or you cut some of it out. You clip it out. And that's what they usually do.
Huh.
All right. When you clip it out, remember you have then a raw hole there. And that hole, cells are very small. Most cells in the body are very small. You withdraw this item that you have inserted, and with it, you're going to pull who knows how many cancer cells out with it. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
But yet with the tiny prostate gland, I know someone who had 10 biopsies done on his prostate before they finally decided, oh, he's got cancer. I told this man, don't do the biopsy. Please just get it out. Do your exercises, your pelvic exercises, so you won't have to wear diapers and be embarrassed. And get yourself a doctor who knows what he's doing and get it out because you'll live. Now, my former husband, Robert Baker, was diagnosed with prostatitis. And I said to him at that time, we weren't very friendly terms. His wife really doesn't like me.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's the way it is sometimes. He still writes on Facebook and things that are, anyway, let's don't go there. The point is that he did not listen to me. He said, I don't want to lose my sexual function, when I said, get it out. Instead, he kept it, and he got the usual seeds, the radiation that's supposed to knock it out, and so on. Finally, he was on chemotherapy. Finally, they're giving him female hormones, trying to stop the scourge going through his body. He dies in agony after all their chemo, after all their radiation, after everything, of bone cancer, and that is such a painful way to go.
Right, that's so sad. They're poking tumors, trying to release cancer so they can treat it, and you're paying them for that privilege. But
they're ignorant, really. They want the biopsy so they can see it under the microscope for several reasons, like, oh, we better not take something out and then find out it's not cancerous. They could sue us, you know. They've got all these excuses, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they can claim ignorance to a degree, but when you find out that the simian virus was in the polio vaccine for decades longer than they said, I mean, I wonder, like, what's an accident and what's a carefully controlled campaign against the people of the country?
Oh, there are so many. If you go and look at the recalls on various, most of them are for recalls on, like, bags that have dirtied up, or they're contaminated, and they're putting blood into the bags or something like that. But every once in a while, you run into one of the vaccines that is so dirty that they have to recall it. You know, they don't like you to know about that, but you can find it online.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you're risk taking so much just fooling around with these vaccines. You're supposed to be some kind of nut if you believe that you shouldn't take every vaccination that the doctor asks you to take. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you that veterinarian, you may have heard this from a talk I've had given before, but a veterinarian with a classic dog, you know, pedigree dog, their puppies, mm-hmm. they give them a test to see how the mother's antibodies are doing, because they do not want to give a vaccination too soon because it can cause all kinds of damages. Mm-hmm. But we give our own human children these tests. So you have a child that's drinking from its mother's breast milk. Okay, and getting all kinds of all the kind of antibodies they need, but they're going to go and throw vaccinations on them at birth. It's called insulting the system when you give them an overburden of something. It's called an insult. We insult the baby's immune system, which is just barely getting started, with a barrage of challenges. All and here they're drinking their mother's milk. The mother is supplying the antibodies that will help kill this stuff off. Well, they don't need a vaccination on many counts if the mother's antibodies have been checked for what they're strong in. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, we have over in Sweden and Scandinavia, Iceland, Finland, Denmark, and like even Germany, they do not require even, well, maybe 11 to 13 vaccinations, whereas in the United States, we begin at 45, 46.
Why not sell people another one if there's no resistance whatsoever?
Well, I try to tell people, what you have here in your bloodstream, think about traffic and how you can have traffic jams and clogging going on at intersections, because literally in some of these overburdened systems, there are so many antibodies, and old antibodies don't work anymore, especially if they're getting flu shots every year. Right. Most of the flu shots are already obsolete because those mutate so quickly, those viruses do. Mm-hmm. So here we actually are having people coming in with livers that are so clogged with antibodies that they're not functioning properly.
Right. Well, I mean, could it have any relation to clogged arteries in the heart? Heart disease being our number one killer.
Guess what? Heart disease is not the number one killer.
Oh.
That's not true. I'll tell you why it looks that way. They do not. They count heart attacks, but they don't tell you where the heart attacks are all coming from. A significant percentage, I say significant when otherwise it's 50-50, whether heart disease and cardiovascular problems, you know, are killing people more than cancers, because a lot of people die from heart attacks from chemotherapy and cancer, and they count that as heart attacks.
So it's very related.
Yeah. So when you add those in, it's a 50-50 throw up. And cancer comes slightly ahead.
Well, they love to fudge data. We know that.
Well, here's another way, and people need to understand. You've heard about 5-year survival rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Sounds good, right? Well, what about 5 years and one day, and the guy dies of cancer? They include him because he's still alive, but the next day he dies. But he's included in that statistic. Worse, it used to be when I was in school as a kid, it was 5 years cancer-free. They don't say that anymore. So now by mixing this 5 years cancer-free with 5 years survival, it makes it look like, hey, you know, some of these cancers are just, they're even level, or they're actually, some of the breast cancers and especially childhood leukemias. And the reason those work so well, first early detection helps a little, but what really we're looking at is anytime you have anything that where you can treat it through the bloodstream directly, leukemia will immediately, some of those chemotherapeutic actions will work because you're working with the blood directly, not in tissues and bone and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had a friend, his name was Ed Sherry, and we called him Tree Frog, and he gave us all kinds of wonderful information about the Kennedy assassination. He was very good to me and often told me who my enemies were because he was friends with them.
Huh.
But Ed had bladder cancer. Those doctors never told him that he should never lie down and put his legs up above, you know, his midriff. Never do it, because if you have bladder cancer, you can go and the cancer cells can actually leak up into the kidneys.
Mm.
So you keep your legs down that way. And of course, you should drink lots of fluid and evacuate your bladder as often as you possibly can. And if I were a doctor treating someone like that, I would throw vitamin C and everything else right up into the bladder. I'd work on it from the inside out. Poor thing. Here, what happened is they said he was going to die in like 3 months. And I asked him what he was doing. And anyway, he went on his very special diet. And it included all your bright colored berries and so on. But mostly the brightly colored vegetables. Anything orange or purple or dark green, all these are good for you. He cut back on pork. Interestingly enough, Denmark has the highest cancer death rate in the world. And they eat more pork than anybody else, and candy. And when you contrast that with the over in Muslim countries where they're not allowed to eat pork, but they're eating camel and all kinds of different foods over there, that I say, well, they drink camel milk, they're eating camel meat and so on, lots of lamb, red meats, they're not getting cancer. And that was also true of your many primitive tribes that were eating just nothing but meat.
Right.
So it's not exactly the meat itself, it is the sugar. And the conversions to sugar, potatoes, for example, would convert right in your mouth, start converting your own saliva, starts converting it into sugar.
You can also look at the patterns of the diets of the Apaches and how it changed over time as an indicator, as some good
Absolutely.
Data.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, I worked with the Apaches. I taught on an Indian reservation out there on the White Mountain. And all what those poor people have gone through. I love them. They are wonderful people. But a lot of them weigh 300 or 400 pounds. They have been forced to stay in one place and to focus on a diet that's very heavy in corn, tortillas, and so on. And unfortunately for them, they have a diabetes epidemic because of it. Now, what I think is fascinating is that, yeah, we had no cancer. You saw no cancer among these Apaches when they were following the buffaloes. They were eating mainly buffalo meat and any dried berries. And once in a while, they would raid, you know, the Navajo, which also are really Apache, but they settled down. They would raid them and get some of their food and take some of their kids, you know, things like that. Well, they were healthy and strong, but now that they're on reservations, they're fat, and frankly, they're ill, they're sick. It's sad to see. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily a diet that avoids meat completely, although with our modern diets and with whatever they're putting in cattle's mouths, you know, probably you should really reduce your red meat too, and watch out if your chicken has hormones in it or whatever. Don't eat it. Stay away from sugar more than anything, and stay away from too much fruit, because fruit sugar, fructose, is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something interesting in our country, we have like almost all your sweeteners now, they're based on corn syrup solids, corn syrup and high fructose syrups. All of these are, they'll give you a good case of diabetes if you're a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And even sugar itself is better off because there's some fructose in it and all that. It's not all sucrose. But even white sugar is better than this corn syrup junk.
Right.
And We have, it's dangerous, that's all, for our people are on a poor diet. You, when you can spend $5 and fill your stomach, and it's all dangerous for you, and you get to get fat, you're going to get, you know, that's all we've got.
And that was one of my questions for you, because as I understand it, if you have this SV40 virus, it mutates into cancer in about 1 in 200 people. Are these things the factors and triggers that determine who that 1 out of 200 is going to be? Or are we just screwed if the damage is already done?
Man, there are so many ways you can trigger stress, for example. Americans are among the highest stressed people, and they work harder than almost anybody else. We've almost doubled our production rates. We haven't given the people the money. What makes me almost laugh is I know so many people, they don't dare take their vacations. It's on paper that they have 2 weeks. They don't dare take it.
Right.
Or, you know, and the other thing is on paper, they're paid maybe time and a half, but they make them work overtime without putting it on the paper, you know. And if they don't do it, they'll be fired. Why? If you can just think, we have so many people overseas that their work week is 37 hours. Or like in France, it's even 30, just 35. They get full benefits, not in America. When I see that we have people overseas are getting free medical care, I saw an 87-year-old woman. She was operated on for stomach cancer. She lived to be 90 after the operation. She was so happy. Her family was happy. In the United States, they never would have given her a chance. And how many people are losing their homes? But let's go back to this trigger factor about the SV40 monkey virus. Almost anything can cause it. I have to go through TSA and get these x-rays, but then I'm also on a plane. I'll be making at the end of July, I'll have made 8 trips over the Atlantic Ocean back and forth, you know, at a high altitude where I'm being bathed in radiation.
Right.
There's nothing I can do about it except try to fortify myself. But I probably will die of cancer. I worked with it. I've even swallowed some of it accidentally. Because when you're working with test tubes and things, you have to suck. You have to suck up the stuff in with pipettes. Yeah, and you have cotton swab at the end. Well, if that cotton swab gets wet because you suck too hard, you're getting it on your mouth, you know?
Yeah. And you've been exposed to a lot of radiation over the years, too.
I was exposed to a lot of radiation. I really should be dead of cancer by now, but I try to take good care of myself. And with all the x-rays and things that people are exposed to, the worst problem of all is nasty, rotten food, sometimes literally, that I can hardly stand some of the food over here, having tasted really good food. And why go back to free medical care over there? Here, you lose your home in order to try and get yourself cured of something. Mm-hmm. We don't have inheritances anymore. When I'm overseas and I see that, I asked my friend George, that was his mother who had stomach cancer. He had it too. Again, add those up. He had it. His mother had it. Well, they had a very poor diet. They liked to eat lots of sugar and they didn't like fruits and vegetables and they got stomach cancer. It's very interesting.
Wow. Yeah, we live in troubled times and people just seem to be letting it all happen.
Well, people feel helpless. When we talked about Gates and all of them, they're giving these shots over in Africa or India. They actually have more polio now than they've ever had. And India has got so upset about it. I think they tried to sue or something. At least they kicked them out because these poor people now have lots more polio than they had before. The definition of polio has changed, you see. It used to be that if you got the fever and the headache or whatever and the aching body and you were paralyzed for, say, several days, but you got over it, they no longer call that polio. Mm. You get that a lot from some of these shots.
Right. They change definitions and symptoms.
Because it has to be a permanent situation. I mean, you know, where you're paralyzed for months, then they say, oh, you have polio. But not you. You don't have it. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a curious thing on that subject, because you do seem to know so much about the medical field and what's going on.
Well, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to help people, you know.
Right.
I've kept up with these things.
Do you have any thoughts on the Morgellon stuff that's happening?
Well, that's why I say in my story, I have plastic actually being created right out of their heads, you know, wherever they want. Here's the thing. It's a shame. I'm not going to say that Morgellons is real. I'm not going to go that far because I don't want to get chomped on, you know, and trodden upon. But frankly, it's possible. It's chemically and biochemically possible because These there are plastics that are so closely related to keratin, human hair, that I can see if a virus, which is very, very small, viruses are smaller than hairs. Most of them are. This is a megavirus. I can see where you could get a viral infection that could take a regular hair and turn it into plastic.
Wow.
It's possible. I'm not saying that's what's going on. I'm saying it is possible. They say all they've done is scratch themselves and they got fibers, you know, in it. It is possible that nanofibers that have been subjected to radiation could maybe be activated when they hit DNA. It could even be a real kind of terrorism to put on. You can imagine if you wake up and you've got hair sprouting all over you, it's green or something. I mean, what could happen to us in the future? These people will try anything. If they could spray whooping cough on us way back in the 50s, what can they do today?
Mm-hmm.
And I say they. Who are they? So many people say, I just do what I'm told. Well, my friends, as long as you do what you're told, we're going to have the world we have.
Mm. Well said. And wow, Judy, it is about time I cut you loose, but I consider this a real milestone for me just to spend some time talking with someone who's so intimately involved with this stuff. And on behalf of the listeners, thanks for putting yourself at risk to get the truth out. It's a noble thing. You're very brave. And to relive this pain
I'm not always brave in the middle of the night.
Well, it cannot be easy. And to relive this pain every time you speak out is got to be difficult.
My friend, but it's what's nice is that you let me, they call it rambling on, my enemies do, you know, she rambles on, but I think I tried to give you a rich picture of what's going on and not just keep it in one spot. You know, we can focus on one spot. I think it'd be kind of boring. I hope that you feel like you've learned something, and I hope it's helped somebody.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
And if anybody wants to go to see some of the stuff at my blogs, it's Judith Baker, J-U-D-Y-T-H, Judith Baker, blogspot.com. You can actually get autographed books there and donations. I don't ask for I've never asked for donations, but I do tell you that there is a button. But that's as far as I'll go. I really appreciate all that people are doing. Sometimes I feel like the last witness standing. They are dying like flies now.
Mm.
So as long as I can speak, and I shall.
Amen. And remind us once more, because you mentioned it in the second hour, I wanted to say it again, the upcoming conference that you have.
Oh, yes. And it's going to be held in Dallas at the Crown Plaza Hotel. You can go to jfkconference.com, or we're also going to put up jfkconferences.com. And the tickets are not that expensive. They're presently $85, $95, like that. And it's for all 3 days. The main thing is that if there's someone who really can't afford it, contact me. I'll try and find a way to get you a ticket, because that's more important than money. This is not, we can't get a tax status that says we're nonprofit. They make it really hard, really
right.
hard for someone like us. But what we do is, and the books are open, people can look. We're not making money off of this thing. I'm selling my paintings. My paintings sell for $6,000. I do not keep the money from that. I can't afford to, actually, because I want people to know I don't keep money on this thing. This story has never been for sale. So it goes straight into the conference. So that's how a lot of it's being actually financed. But there are people who have really stuck their necks out here and helped finance it. These conferences are not cheap, but we have probably the best one in the world on this subject.
Right on.
And we're going to have another. Because of all that's going on, we're going to have one in Washington, D.C. We almost had one in Europe, but the legalities are kind of complicated. We probably will have one next year also in Mexico City. Looking that way, these people are really excited. They love Kennedy, and they haven't been told the truth. They really want to know it, even if they have to hear it through translators.
Mm. Right on. A lot of stuff happening, for sure.
Take down the Tippit sign. Somebody, I'm not saying take down the Tippit sign, but that's what I hear some people saying, all right?
I'll say it. Yeah, take that Tippit sign down.
We've got to do something here to start turning it around. How dare the city of Dallas be the judge and jury of Lee Oswald?
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, hey, Judy, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you and talking to you.
Well, thank you, Greg.
Absolutely, absolutely. Keep fighting the good fight and do take care of yourself out there. It's dangerous.
Join me on Facebook, and that's where I can help people, and it makes me really happy. I always tell them I have to, you know, be sure to see your doctor, you know, get the information from the doctor. Don't just believe me or all that. But I do hope that I could help people and in some way, at least, even though I couldn't go ahead and cure cancer like I hoped or even be a doctor, I have been able to help some people. And that helps. Well, that dries some of my tears.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're definitely making a difference in more ways than one. Thanks again.
All right. And thank all of you. Just thank you so much for everybody. I'm just so grateful.
Perfect.
Bye-bye, Greg.
Boom, people. Judith Very Baker. I feel a little special getting this interview to be one person removed from Lee Harvey Oswald. It's a cool feeling. But Judy is a very kind and empathetic woman, and I know she's stressed out. This wasn't exactly an easy interview to secure, and her having a scientific and medical background, as well as coming forward with this story where I'm sure she's taken a lot of criticism and people picking apart her words, trying to find holes or ways to discredit this saga. So I understand, and I don't mind all the talking over me. I think she's just trying to be hyper-vigilant about her words and everything that comes out and how it comes out because of so much scrutiny. So I get it. The details have to be on point and consistent, but as interesting as the love affair angle is, I wanted to spend more time talking about the Weaponized Cancer Project, especially after last week's show with Patrick Jordan. I mean, the Weaponized Cancer Project and the polio vaccine connection is something that affects all of us way more than a love affair with Lee Harvey Oswald, as interesting as it is. Also, if you're trying to get a feel for her truthfulness and legitimacy, I think that's easier to feel out when talking about something like the medical establishment, and she definitely seems to know her stuff. Do check out Me and Lee if you need any more evidence to go on, because she throws a whole lot in there. But I thought it was a great show. I've been pretty preoccupied with the medical and nutritional conspiracies lately. Not that I have a lot of other ones planned in this realm, but it's probably my biggest area of struggle personally. You know, eating right and avoiding the barrage of processed foods, and eating a diet more geared for just health in general, and exercise. Of course, it's all easier said than done, but if you look at the three pillars of happiness, typically being your romantic life, your financial life, and your health, I'm with someone I love, doing a job I love, but that third pillar is sort of in shambles, and we should always focus on bringing our weaknesses up to the level of our strengths rather than just writing them off as, well, I just don't do good in that area. Screw that. I mean, everybody's capable of being in great health. Everyone can have a six-pack if they want one. Just do the work. Try it out. But because of all that, I like the medical and nutritional topics we've kind of gotten into lately, and the cancer conversation always leads to one about health and nutrition. So we got a little bit of it today. Of course, if you like the first hour, sign up for Plus, support the show that you know you love, you know I work hard on, and you know you've been listening to for free for a long time. $5, hear the whole thing. In today's Plus show, some of the big things we got into were how the use of antibiotics has decreased the cleanliness standards in hospitals and how ultraviolet lights in hospitals could improve sanitation and probably save a lot of lives, if that was the goal. And we got into some details about Lee's widow, Marina Oswald, the couple's marriage, and why Marina won't speak out on her husband's behalf. I was really curious to ask Judy, who's been very public about her affair with Lee, if she's ever spoken with Lee's wife or family. She's still alive, so I was curious, but it is a bit awkward, and we did get into that. We also talked about what some of Judy's critics have said about her work, lies they've told, her rebuttals and explanations, and the danger she's been in. We also got into the Ted Cruz thing, insights into the relationship to Ted Cruz's father, Rafael, who was in Dallas at the time of the JFK assassination. We talked about why he was there, how suspicious it is that someone connected to such a deep project and propaganda would then have a son who is one of the selected few who gets to maybe be a presidential nominee. And I was also surprised this story kind of hit the mainstream a little bit after talking to Ed Haslam about it. You know, Trump wasn't wrong on this one. I think he's the guy who brought it up and put it out in the media, and then they quickly buried it. And Judy had more to add on that topic. So All good stuff. I'm really happy with the roster for the next 8 shows or so. Half of them are already recorded. I think you're going to be pretty impressed. But that's it for me, and I guess I'll see you soon with the 5th show of June. Your move, orchestrators of the chemo industrial complex, the cancer cure cover-up, and bioweapon wielders of the power pyramid. Your fucking move.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man behind blue eyes. And no one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dreams aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be. Since they exposed me on THC. No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do, and I blame you. No one bites back as hard on their anger. None of my pain and woe can show through. But my dreams aren't as empty as my conscience.
Guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the 5 shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the Entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?